Gun laws and a new administration, the truth on recycling, and Boca's Jewish Oprah. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. President Biden wants to do something about assault weapons. Democrats now control the House and Senate, and the NRA is dealing with bankruptcy. Could gun control legislation be passed this time around? Also, one in five items that go to recycling aren't recyclable. Do you know what you're throwing in your bin? We'll learn why recycling isn't working in this country now and what could be done to make it better. And finally,
I don't run a tight ship. Wherever that question lands, it's important to that person.
We meet Trudy Berlin, the host of a weekly Zoom show in Boca Raton. She's been dubbed the Jewish Oprah. She'll share some of her 98 years of wisdom and how she's continuing during COVID. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, it's been decades of activists pushing for federal gun reform and laws that never get passed. But recent changes in Washington have some activists feeling optimistic. President Joe Biden remembered the Parkland school shooting by calling on Congress to pass stricter gun laws that include a ban on assault weapons. Also, the National Rifle Association, which has lobbied heavily against gun reform measures, is now facing bankruptcy. Still, gun sales surged last year. Joining us now is Christine Stapleton. She's a political reporter for the Palm Beach Post and USA Today Network. Christine, great to have you.
Thanks very much.
So, Christine, when was the last time that the government actually passed a gun safety law?
Well, Florida lawmakers did take some action after the Parkland shooting in 2018. They upped the age for the minimum purchase of a gun to 21, and they imposed a three-day waiting period on gun purchases from dealers. Now, at the federal level, it was 1994 when the government, when lawmakers banned assault rifles, and they actually banned them until 2004, and then the ban was lifted. And Joe Biden was instrumental in getting that federal ban.
Mm. So earlier this month, Georgia Republican Marjorie Taylor Greene lost her seat in two House committees because she doubted and spread false theories about school shootings. Three Republicans from South Florida broke party lines to remove her from her committees. Is this giving people hope that lawmakers across the aisle are going to come together on some kind of gun safety measure, depending on what it is, but they might actually work together this time?
Well, you know, that's the big question. Now, when it came to the removal of the Georgia Congresswoman from her committees, there were other things besides just the false flag shooting accusation that she had made about Parkland and Las Vegas shootings. But still, it was we did see some crossover in that. And the focus, much of the focus was on her claims about the Parkland shooting. So it does appear that there may be some effort for some bipartisanship on this issue. But her case, or the instance with Marjorie Taylor Greene, also brought to light the fact that these conspiracy theories, some of them about mass shootings, are just so far out there. And I think it really awakened people to the fact that, you know, this is for some people, a real belief. And a lot of people believe we need to put a stop to this, including Republicans.
So we know that Representative Debbie Wasserman Schultz is planning to reintroduce Jamie's Law. Briefly remind us again what that entails.
Jamie's Law is interesting. It imposes universal background checks on ammunition sales. And it has not passed in prior sessions. But it may have a better chance this time around. The climate in Washington is much different than it was before when this bill came up.
And there's also another one I want to bring up, too, is the Luke and Alex School Safety Act being reintroduced by two Florida Democrats, one Republican. It's an act that also honors those who were killed in the school shooting in Parkland. What would this act change exactly?
Well, this would create a federal clearinghouse that would categorize and assess, and it would share the best practices for school safety measures and it would identify resources that are necessary to implement them. So it doesn't sound like it's a terribly controversial bill. And like you had mentioned, we do have two Florida Republicans and two Florida Democrats who are putting this forward. So it'll be interesting to see how this progresses with this type of bipartisan initiative.
And again, is there a sense that like this one, like Jamie's Law, that there's maybe hope for, or there's a reason for optimism?
I think so. I really think so. I think the combination of the fact that you have, the new administration, you have President Biden, who has repeatedly over the decades, promoted himself and done what he can to push for gun reform, safety reform. And, with the NRA and with, the Democrats are controlling the gavels in both the House and the Senate. So I think there's real chance for some of these bills that don't seem that controversial, that are more common sense bills, like the Luke and Alex School Safety Act that is being pushed by the Florida lawmakers. I would think that might have a really good shot.
Just to mention too, by the way, I want to note Jamie's Law is, Jamie Gutenberg, who was a student who lost her life in Parkland. Going back though, because I mean, as you mentioned, we haven't seen major gun reform since the 90s. But I mean, come on, at one point Obama had control of the House and Senate and was unable to get any meaningful gun control passed after Sandy Hook because there was a filibuster. So how optimistic can they be?
I think the difference between now and then, besides the fact that, hundreds of more people have been killed, is that, I think the difference is that the members of the House and Senate are different now. And I think that the NRA has lost its power. I mean, there was a time where lawmakers really sought out the annual ratings that the NRA gives. They would rate lawmakers as a
They would
A+
give them a report
lawmaker.
Card, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And, lawmakers don't want that anymore. So I think there's been a shift, with the way people feel about the NRA and the way lawmakers feel about the NRA. So I think we're in a much different climate, even though, like you said, back in that period, there was Democratic control of the House and Senate. I think things are different now.
I'm talking with Christine Stapleton, political reporter for the Palm Beach Post and the USA Today Network. And we're talking about gun reform with the new president and changes in Congress. And as she mentioned, with the NRA, could we see new gun laws on the horizon? Again, President Biden wants to press some gun reform in his first 100 days. Again, you can find Christine's reporting on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Let's talk about the National Rifle Association. They've been facing a lot of issues over the last few years, accusations of corruption earlier this year. The nonprofit filed for bankruptcy. So are they able to do any kind of lobbying right now? What's happened to them?
Well, yes, they're still doing, a considerable amount of lobbying, but there's a lot of questions out there about the NRA. And what's interesting is that, it's not just the bankruptcy or just the accusations. It's the fact that the New York State's Attorney General has actually sued to dissolve the NRA because of the accusations of, misappropriation of money. People have asked, oh, is that even possible? And if you remember, the same thing happened with the Trump Foundation when the New York State's Attorney General found that there was corruption and misappropriated funds in the foundation, and they shut the foundation down, the Trump Foundation. So it is a real possibility that the New York State's Attorney General could actually have the NRA dissolved. And so I think people, once they started seeing the extent of the misappropriation that's been alleged, are really disillusioned with the NRA. And I think we're seeing more and more lawmakers and just the general public disillusioned with the NRA.
Did we see, I want to remember after Parkland, you had activists, a lot of young people going up to Tallahassee. And I'm wondering, what role they might have played in their pushback against the NRA. Did they have any impact on the financial issues the NRA had?
No, things have not changed at all in Tallahassee from the sources I've spoken with and the lawmakers up there. I think from an emotional point of view, what the students did in Tallahassee was had a tremendous impact. But in Tallahassee, it has just not translated into any significant legislation being passed. You know, just those two smaller bills that passed after Parkland, but there's really very little hope that anything will be passed in this upcoming session in Tallahassee.
Yeah. Look, we've been talking about all these changes, right? So, I mean, the Democrats have the House, the Senate, the White House. Okay. And the NRA is in trouble. Okay. But gun sales are up. And I'm wondering, look, what's really changed with attitudes and opinions about guns? I mean, do the voters want gun reform right now?
Yes. Yes. It's been like this for a very long time. But yes, you're right on both fronts. The gun sales has spiked last year during the pandemic. The Washington Post did an analysis and found that there were 23 million gun sales over the course of the year, which is about a 64% increase over the 2019 sales. And, you know, that is basically attributed to the pandemic, and people were going into supermarkets and seeing that there was no toilet paper on the shelves and water, and those types of things started really instilling a fear in Americans that drove many to go out and buy weapons. And it was interesting because some of the analysis also showed that about a third of those were first time gun buyers. So obviously the pandemic had that impact. But people still do want responsible gun safety reform.
All right. How much of a priority is this really for the White House, considering everything that the president's got to deal with? He's got an economy that's still staggering. COVID-19 is still a problem. We're trying to get vaccines out. How important is gun reform to Biden?
Well, in February of 2020, he was on the campaign trail. And at that time, right before the pandemic really picked up, he was saying at campaign stops that his first day in office, he was going to sign, you know, an executive order, do what he could to stop, to implement an assault weapon ban again. And then he was promising his first day in office, he would do that. Well, obviously that didn't happen. But I think it's indicative of what type of emphasis this administration will place on gun reform, and especially on banning assault weapons. So I think it's very high up there, but you're right. I mean, we certainly have the economy and COVID are the number one priorities, but I have a feeling that, you know, very quickly we will see something out of the White House on at least on some type of assault weapon ban.
You know, I want to come back real quickly to some of the folks you've talked to, you spoke with, you heard from Jamie Guttenberg's father, Fred, and some other gun reform advocates. And I'm wondering, what have they said about, you know, how they're going to move forward in this era, you know, with this new administration? And again, still in the pandemic, and maybe attitudes have changed. But what are they saying about how they're approaching it this time?
Well, from what I'm hearing across the board, people are as optimistic now, gun right advocates are as optimistic now as they have ever been. But they do understand that it's still an uphill battle, even though you have, you know, the White House, the law, the Senate, Congress, the NRA, everything. It appears that the stars are aligning, but the gun right advocates still know there are huge obstacles that will be in their way. So they're going forward with a lot of optimism, and I think we will see more legislation. I think we'll hear a lot more about it on social media, on television, and there'll be a much louder debate about it now than there has been in the last 4 years.
Mm. Christine Stapleton, political reporter for the Palm Beach Post and the USA Today Network. Check out more of her work on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Christine, thank you so much for the insight. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Have a good day.
And you know what? We want to hear from you. What are your thoughts on this? What do you think gun reform is going to look like in this new administration? Does it have a chance? Should it have a chance to pass? You know how you can share those thoughts with us? You can stay in touch with us via text. Just join our Sundial Text Club. Send us your thoughts, your comments, your questions about issues like this one, for example, and we'll get back to you. You'll also get the opportunity to get involved in future shows. Again, join the text club. Text the word hello to 786 677 786-777-0767. Again, that's hello, the word hello, to 786-677-0767. Can't wait to hear from you. Well, still to come, that bowling ball does not belong in your recycling. We're going to learn what's wrong with recycling in America. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. It's sad to say, but a lot of the stuff that you're putting in your recycling bin shouldn't be in there. And that is slowing down the process of properly recycling the materials. We've been recycling for years, but are we even doing it right? Well, David Bitterman is the executive director and CEO of Solid Waste Authority of North America. And we spoke with him recently about how the pandemic has affected the amount of waste that we create. But we also talked a lot about the process of recycling and how we could be doing a better job. Let's walk through the basic process of recycling in 2021. I don't think it's something that we think about that often. I think we just assume we know. But, you know, let's say, for example, I just finished drinking my Coke. I have it in a Coke bottle, and I toss it into recycling. The truck comes every Thursday. Where does that go? What happens to it?
So most of the recyclables that are put out at the curb end up going to a recycling facility. The recycling facility separates the plastic, the paper, the metal, and the glass into separate bales or loose material in the glass area. And then that material is then sold to companies that use or purchase used plastic or discarded paper, and they incorporate that recovered material into a new product.
So what's the likelihood that glass bottle that I was drinking out of is going to be turned into some kind of reusable material?
So with glass, it certainly depends on the local marketplace. Glass is a very heavy material, and so glass does not travel long distances once it's been put in a recycling bin, unlike paper or plastic, which will go hundreds of miles because you can pack a lot of paper into a bale of paper. The glass, if there's no glass market locally, oftentimes that glass is used for other purposes. It can be used as feedstock for the roadbed, which is why you sometimes see that little bit of a glitter when you see a newly paved road. Sometimes it's used as daily cover at a landfill instead of covering the garbage with dirt at the end of the day, as is required by law. Glass can be used to do that as well.
Wow. All right. So then depending on the material, I'm curious, what material recycles better or is more likely to be recycled? Is it tin, the tin can, the bottle, paper, what?
So in terms of value, metal is very valuable, and steel cans and other metal cans have a higher recycling rate than other components of the waste stream, particularly plastic, which is only recycled at about a 9% rate nationally. The biggest piece of what comes out of people's houses is paper. So cardboard from Amazon boxes, junk mail, and other paper products, that is the majority by weight of the material that's running through a recycling facility and is where most recycling companies and local governments are making money on recycling.
Well, can you speak to, I guess, that local market? And I'm wondering, nationally, are there regions that are really good at certain kinds of recyclables?
In the Midwest and the South, there's markets for glass because automobile manufacturers and beer bottlers and other industrial purchasers are looking to buy used glass. That's not as true in other parts of the country that don't have that heavy industry. And it's my suspicion that South Florida does not have a lot of markets like that in Dade or Broward counties.
You know, I think about it as a consumer. I think that I just put the recyclables into the bin and then it's out of mind. And I'm just like, I trust that's going where it needs to go. But there's no system of knowing how much of that material is actually being recycled or that it's going somewhere. I don't even know what happens to it.
So one of the challenges that we have in the United States is that people don't know what is recyclable, and they don't know whether or not the material that they're putting in the recycling bin is actually going to be recycled. The vast majority of items that are put in a recycling bin are recycled into a new product. Companies are eager to purchase discarded plastic, paper, and metal. And if that material is clean and in good shape, there is a market for it. One of the challenges that we faced over the last few years has been as the foreign markets, principally China, began to go away and are no longer interested in receiving imported recycling from the United States. We've seen an adjustment over the last couple of years with new paper mills being constructed, with new facilities being permitted in the South to take more plastic. And we're seeing increased usage on the domestic side for the material that we're throwing away.
So, and I didn't realize this, I mean, mass recycling has been around in this country for more than 60 years, but I'm wondering, technology in that industry, how has it changed? And like, what's different today compared to 20, 30 years ago?
So there's two significant differences. The first is that the material going through the recycling facility itself has changed. 20 years ago, newspapers were being recycled in huge quantities, and of course, people don't read newspapers anymore. And I apologize to our friends at the Miami Herald who might be listening. But as a result of that, many of these facilities are not sized properly for this evolving waste stream. So when I say evolving waste stream, I mean more plastic is coming in, more cardboard is coming in because of Amazon. So now let me speak to technology. Companies are investing in technologies like robotics, where you have a robot doing the sorting as opposed to a human being, because the robot is able to work 24/7 and doesn't take sick days, and there isn't the same risk of safety risk associated with that person possibly being injured. So we're seeing a big increase over the last couple of years in the use of robotics at recycling centers.
Is recycling as efficient as it could be, though? Because we had found that according to the EPA, only a quarter of the solid waste received by recycling centers was actually recycled in 2017. That doesn't sound very efficient.
So only a quarter of the material that was generated in the United States was recycled. It's not that 25% of the material that was inbound at a recycling facility was recycled. But Luis, having said that, we certainly could make our recycling system more efficient. One of the things we could do is to make sure that all of us only put things that are recyclable into the recycling bins. So people are putting in plastic bags, hoses, bowling balls, and other things that are simply not recyclable. If we don't take up the recycling capacity for those items and put more of the good stuff, the plastic bottle, the metal can, the cardboard box, if we put more of those items in the recycling bin, we will make the system more efficient.
Is the impetus then more on, I guess, the companies producing these items, or is it more on, you know, what we buy? If we're buying, if we're as a consumers, we're taking the initiative to look for things that's easily recyclable.
So I think that everybody in the supply chain has a role to play to make the system more efficient. I think that producers should be using recycled content in all of their containers and in more of their products. I also think that plastic companies and others should be helping to fund the cost of recycling and the cost of building a recycling infrastructure that can handle the myriad containers that they're generating. I think consumers have a very significant role to play as well. We need to vote with our wallets. And if we care about recycling, be willing to pay a couple of pennies extra for a recycled container as opposed to something that's made from non-recycled material.
We're talking with David Bitterman. He's the executive director and CEO of SWANA. That's a Solid Waste Association of North America. And we're talking about recycling. We're talking specifically about recyclables. Where do they go? And how could we be better at recycling? I wanted to ask you a little bit about, you know, solid waste management and, you know, how it's adapting to the changing world, especially when you talk about climate change. I mean, we know how vulnerable Miami's water management systems are because of sea level rise, but I'm wondering how solid waste management is adapting nationally to this question. Is it even, how often is it talked about?
So climate change is on the radar screen for SWANA and its members. Many solid waste facilities are located in vulnerable locations, in flood zones. After Hurricane Sandy, Superstorm Sandy in the Northeast about 9 years ago, some of the principal solid waste facilities were offline for 10 days because they had been flooded by 9 feet of seawater rise. So we need to be making sure that we're not siting facilities next to next to canals, next to the Biscayne Bay. They need to be sited smartly. They need to be constructed with resiliency in mind, which might mean elevating some of those facilities to reduce the possibility of flooding. And we also have to take into account the fact that the workforce may have trouble getting to a recycling facility or some other solid waste facility immediately after a storm. And the increased frequency of storms, both tropical systems in South Florida, as well as hurricanes in the heartland of the country, and fires in California, are all stressing the system.
From your experience, you know, how do you rate how the United States approaches recycling compared to other countries? Do other countries, you know, put as much emphasis on recycling and educating their population as we do?
So I think we're probably in the middle. I think some countries do a better job and put a greater emphasis on that, and other countries do not do as good a job as the United States does. We have to take the best practices from other places, Canada, some places in Europe, and make sure that we do the best job possible, not just about recycling, but on waste reduction. We can't just say, oh, we need to recycle more. We actually need to consume less and reduce the amount of material we're placing at the curb. My industry is a service provider at the end of the pipe, and we will manage whatever material Americans put out to be collected. But we need to put out less material if we're going to avoid these environmental harms associated with marine plastic or climate change.
I wonder if there are any innovations that are coming down the pipe that you could talk about, things that might be really exciting, whether in waste management or recycling, that could be a game changer.
Well, I actually think that robotics in the MRF is potentially a game changer. We've seen that be introduced over the last few years. Robotics in recycling facilities seems to be a game changer. And then we're layering on top of that artificial intelligence. So the people who run the facility are able to anticipate, because of the time of day or because of whose truck came in, whether that load is going to be primarily composed of one material or another. And as a result of that, we can make the process more efficient. We can reduce the cost of processing recyclables, and we can increase the quality of the material that comes out of the back of the recycling facility.
Something you said a moment ago is really interesting. You know, it's our, if we, you know, consume less, we obviously would produce less waste. But we did see over this pandemic that, well, people were stuck in their houses. So what were they doing? They were ordering a lot of things from Amazon, as you pointed out. So lots of deliveries, lots of packages, lots of stuff. And so, you know, we produce more waste because we're just sitting at home. But I don't know. Have you seen it get really a lot worse during the pandemic? Did you see that?
So we saw two things happen when the pandemic hit in the spring of 2020. Residential waste increased substantially, about 20% nationally. But commercial waste decreased by even more when schools and offices closed, when people stopped traveling, when the hospitality industry basically shut down. We saw much less waste coming out of that side of the industry. The net is actually a decline. We probably generated less waste in 2020 than we did in 2019 as a country. But we generated much more of it on the residential side. And that's the side that's visible to most Americans. They're aware of what they're generating. And as you mentioned, between panic shopping and spring cleaning and other things, we certainly saw an uptick in waste from the residential side last year.
Let me finish with this. Just the thing I was thinking about is the system for recycling efficient enough that companies have that incentive to want to recycle, that it's something that promotes for industry to want to recycle?
For most companies, the system is sufficiently robust that we could take more recycled material through the solid waste system. whether it's plastic, whether it's metal, whether it's paper. What we really need are for Americans to make sure that they're throwing away the garbage and putting the valuable paper, plastic, and metal into the recycling bin. We can handle that material. And companies are aware that consumers, particularly younger people, are very interested in sustainability and want to see companies demonstrating that they care about the environment and the planet.
And that was David Bitterman, Executive Director and CEO of Solid Waste Authority of North America. Share with us on social media at WLR and Sundial how you are recycling. And also you could post your questions there about maybe how we could be doing it better. One of the things he said, by the way, is do not put your bowling balls in the recycle bin. Bowling balls are very challenging. Also, very few places might even be able to try. Better yet, just give it away. Sell it. So anyway, we spoke with Mike Fernandez, director of Miami-Dade Solid Waste Management. He told us that South Florida is not a hub for glass recycling. There aren't the industries to sell it here. However, cardboard recycling, especially during the pandemic, has been huge for the region. So remember, recycle your boxes. And by the way, we spoke with a panel of experts about plastic pollution earlier this month. We talked about whether plastic bans could be good for the environment. You could find that conversation on our social media, also at WLRN Sundial. Well, still to come, we're going to meet Trudy Berlin, a 98-year-old Boca resident who is the Oprah to her community. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. For the past 20 years, Trudy Berlin has engaged in conversation with dozens of women through her program, The Ladies' Room. It's at the JCC Levis Center in Boca Raton. The 98-year-old has been affectionately deemed the Jewish Oprah of the center for her approach to interviewing and the ability to connect with different communities. Berlin has spent her life as an educator and college instructor, working for years as a professor at Sarah Lawrence in New York. She sees her program as a continuation of that learning, even now as it's being conducted through Zoom. Here's part of this past Tuesday show.
Thank you. And I will later talk what this period has done for me, but I want to hear from all of you first.
Marjorie.
Yes, well, part of me is like Myrna in that, you know, I have a lot of Zooming and book clubs and activities and reading that, you know, fill me up, which is a good thing. But I have to say, I just moved here a little over maybe 3.5 years ago. And, you know, I left a job that I loved and a place that I loved and a whole I came down here and I pushed myself out so that I could meet people and establish a life here, although I had to move in with my family, so I had my family responsibility.
So we spoke with Berlin last week about her experience as an educator and a host during these challenging times. Trudy, you know, I wanted to start by asking you, you know, you've spent so much of your life as an educator, but also you're a connector of communities. But, you know, at what point in your life did you realize that that's your mission? That's your life's purpose and your passion is bringing people together.
I guess I always enjoyed talking to people. I had two phases of college. I went to college when I was in my 20s for 2 years, to Russell Sage, where my major was really psychology. Then came marriage and a beautiful daughter who is now a doctor. And I went back to Sarah Lawrence. And so when I went back, I was 39. And when I was asked about, I had an interview with the president, Esther Rauschenbusch, and I asked her how long it would take me to get my degree. I was very, very age conscious. And she said, well, since you've had only 2 years, it probably would take you about 5 years. And they would not take women anyway unless they had 2 years of college. So when I went back to Sarah Lawrence, I finished my degree, but the second part, the master's, was in college teaching. And that is really where the focus came in.
Okay. And during your career as an educator, how would you describe that?
They were wonderful. I learned that learning was what I love to do. I still think I'm a very gregarious person in many ways, but learning has been it. And I think when I came to Florida and I was afraid that I was going to be cut off from things, and then I discovered the Sandler Center. My life really unfolded then, really, because I found an oasis. And so the Levis, JCC, and the Sandler helped me to go on teaching and doing what I love to do.
I wanted to ask you about like the ladies' room, because it's been going on so long. Just can you tell me, how did that start exactly? I mean, who started it?
Well, the ladies' room started here 20 years ago, really. There was another director here at that time, Sally Oaken, and then Susanna Flom. And one of them, I was taking courses here before I started my own course. Someone told me about Sandler Center, and I thought, oh, this sounds good. And then when I spoke to Sally Oaken, and she said, what did you do in New York? And I explained to her, I had gotten my BA and my MA from Sarah Lawrence after college teaching. And she said, how would you like to start a group here, try it? So the first group, I think I had 5 or 6 people. I kind of bribed my friends. I'd take them to dinner if they'd come to the class. And they came, and then it turned out to be we were so busy talking about things that were important to us at the time and the news and what was happening that it just grew. And it has an energy of its own.
I wonder, you know, because you talk about so many things within this group and you think about everybody's experiences. Everyone's lived such a long life and had so many experiences. I mean, you've had so many experiences. I mean, you know, losing your father when you were young, your husband really when you were young, and other people in the group share those stories. I wonder, what's your approach when you talk to people and they start talking about some of this really difficult stuff? How do you do that?
Well, I really, I prepare in a way for what I'm going to do. But it never really turns out the way exactly how I prepared, because I will give them either recount a new story or a piece of poetry I've read or something in the theater I've experienced, and then sort of say, what do you think about it? Now, I have found for me, I don't run a tight ship. I like to, wherever that question lands, it's important to that person, and they will take it anywhere that they want to go. I've tried to keep it that way.
You know, what is it like when you guys have a disagreement? And as you said, you start talking about certain topics that can get very heated, like politics. But what are those conversations like? And how do you, because the way they described it is you keep it cool. How do you do that?
Well, I say the person who raises the voice loses the argument. You know, sometimes that works. I did have a group here called Psychology of the News, which I loved for many years. I found out something. You may not like what I say, but having men in the group was not as much fun, and it had a different tone. The men were out to destroy or murder or something. The women were more liable to listen and to discuss. And so what happens is, if it gets heated, you know, I say, whoa, you know. So it usually they listen to each other and then disagree. I always say, if you want to disagree, absolutely, because I believe in free speech. I believe in disagree, but at least be pleasant and let's go on without.
You know what I wanted to ask you about? You remember that first time when, you know, when the pandemic hit and now you couldn't meet in your regular group, but then the idea came, well, let's just all meet online. What was that like that very first time you turn on the Zoom and hear all these people in front of you? And now, yeah, what was that like?
It was so, I was sitting right here and Stephanie had set up, Stephanie Owens had set up the computer. And then she turned on and all of a sudden I saw faces coming up like a checkerboard. And there was such a feeling. I think I cried a little because it was like a miracle. Because from out of darkness came light. And I look forward to Tuesdays. We're all here. And it's like, we're together again. It's a group and the ties are strong. I hate when that Tuesday ends and the screen goes dark again, because I think actually time alone is okay. There are people, and I enjoy alone meeting or something, but without people, it can be absolutely completely isolating.
Yeah.
So it was a miracle to me. The whole Zoom is a miracle. Remember, I don't want to repeat my age, but this technology is new to me. It's a new language, and I have been taught it very carefully. I'm still learning.
Yeah. Oh, no, trust me. I'm also still learning how this thing works. You know what? Trudy, who was the first person that called you the Jewish Oprah?
I think the article that appeared in, what was it? In
the Washington Post.
Washington Post, yeah. The Washington Post. And actually, I thought about it, and I'm quite flattered because I liked Oprah. I watched Oprah always. I liked the way she gets along with people. I liked her style. I liked the fact of the group and the thing. So really, I'm very, very flattered. I'm exceedingly flattered.
Are you looking forward to the day when we can get back to just sitting in a room together?
Oh, I'll invite you there when that happens. We even talk about it. It's, I said, I'm going to have a big, big party, and we're going to have chocolate cake and all the things, and we're just going to sit and talk and talk and talk. And it's been a dream of mine because Tuesday is very, very precious to me, Tuesday, Tuesday morning. And the friendships are very important to me. I think the main thing about the ladies' room, we've grown to trust each other. And in a world today when the world is very untrusting and very angry and isolated, you have to have some kind of support. So it's like, it really is like a second family. And I know most of them are much younger than I am. So I think I wondered at what time, you know, how long I would be wanted or something. But somehow, age, I've always felt too, there should be more mixtures. I don't like, we're not playing in sandboxes anymore, so there's no reason why 50 or 60 year old women can't be groups with 70 and 80, and we could learn from each other and help each other. It has been an experience.
Let me finish with this. Are you thinking about next Tuesday's show? Do you have any idea what kind of stuff you want to talk about?
Yeah, a couple of things have come up to me that I'm really interested. I was reading Deborah Tannen's book before, and I'm rereading about her book now, You Just Don't Understand. And I never understood why men acted the way they did and women the way they did. And she made me really understand. I think her analysis of it is good. She did say men are out for contests. They have violent games. They like violent sports. They have to win. Women are out for community. And I think it's true. Women want to be liked. Now there are differences because I think we have different characteristics, male and female, within us. But I think more and more that the women are somehow, it can go into the personal, the spiritual. It's not all by any means straight, you know, learning or thing. It's something, I love the idea of a creative evolution, that we are and should be inspired in growing to become better human beings. And if we don't, we are in trouble.
That is Trudy Berlin, host of The Ladies' Room at the JCC Sandler Center in Boca Raton. The conversation happens every Tuesday morning at 10 a.m. You can find photos and more information on our social media about it at WLRN Sundial. Absolutely love her. Just again, 98 years old. I got to tell you, Trudy, you are an inspiration to me. I got to keep myself busy. I also agree, don't let men in on the conversation. It's a lot more fun if you let them just watch. By the way, I just want to remind you that you can join our Sundial Text Club. You can send your thoughts about anything you hear on the program, you know, or things you want to hear on the program. Send the word hello to 786-677-0767. Again, that's the word hello to 786-677-0767. Well, that's Sundial for this Wednesday, February 17th. Sundial Senior Producer is Chris Remington. Leslie Ovalle is our producer and social media editor. Our intern is Saria Reimer. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Our news director is Taryn Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's program director is Jason Zapka, and our technical supervisor is Peter J. Meritz. Don't forget, our theme music is by the Miami Afro-Cuban funk band Balo at gobalo.com. If you missed any of the show, you can always tune again tonight at 8 o'clock to catch it, or just find it on your podcast app. All right, coming up tomorrow on the program, we're going to get an update on the ongoing situation in Haiti. Thousands have taken to the street in protest calling for President Jovenel Moise to step down. Plus, the New World Symphony's gala is going virtual this year, featuring performances from Yo-Yo Ma to Gil Shazam. Editorial Director Alicia Zuckerman spoke with conductor Michael Tilson-Thomas and board member Judith Roden about resilience during COVID and the future of classical music. By the way, we continue season 3 of Live from the 305, introducing you to the band Magic City Hippies. They've gone from playing bars in Coconut Grove to touring the country and headlining music festivals. All that coming up tomorrow on the show. By the way, if you missed out our conversation with Karen Russell on in the Sundial Book Club this week, just go to WLRN Sundial, look it up. It was a great conversation. She's the author of Swamplandia. That's the February title for the Sundial Book Club. Next week, we announce the March title. Find us on Facebook, Sundial Book Club. We'd love to have you join us. I'm Luis Hernandez. As always, stay safe, be good to each other. We'll talk to you live tomorrow.